Welcome to episode 4 of season 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
Yes, you are, and I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode, we're looking at Year 12 homework.
That's right. So we chose three films which are being studied by Year 12 students that we know. Mm-hmm. And here in Australia, for those who are not from these shores, Year 12 is the last year of secondary school. So we're trying to help out in a book club kind of way mm-hmm. by giving our opinions on these particular filmic texts.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Ricardo, that this has probably been the most intimidating prep I've done for an episode. I think back to my school days, just a few years ago, and the kinds of questions that you would get for, you know, it was books back then.
We didn't
study films.
Yeah.
And, compare and contrast, or what do you think is the primary theme in this text?
Oh, jeepers, yeah.
We're probably not going to talk about
that style, folks.
Think
so. Do you know, every time I was asked to read the book, I watched the movie, so.
Oh, is that how you ended up?
That's
where you ended up?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, so this is not going to be like that.
No.
It's not even going to be a classroom discussion, but we hope at least it's some kind of input to those who are studying this text.
That's
so, you know, take it as it is.
So, all right, knuckle down, all right?
Yes, Mr. DiGregorio.
So get on with it. Let's talk about Streetcar Named Desire.
Why, they told me to take a streetcar named Desire and then transfer to one called Cemetery and ride 6 blocks and get off at Elysian Fields. So that just emphasises why I'm the film watcher, not the filmmaker. But it's this rather heavy-handed opening line that introduces us to Blanche DuBois, Vivian Leigh, a faded Southern Belle schoolteacher who has come to visit her New Orleans sister, Stella, Kim Hunter. So, you know, in that school class analysis kind of way, she's travelling from lust to oblivion and hopefully salvation. Stella is now in a volatile but passionate marriage to Stanley Kowalski, played by Marlon Brando in his prime. And they are at a critical stage as they await their first child. Sex on a stick Stanley does not get on with the mannered Blanche from the get-go. But that doesn't stop Blanche from developing a romance with Stanley's more genteel wartime buddy, Mitch, Carl Malden. It's fairly clear that Blanche is fleeing a hometown scandal, mainly because she and playwright Tennessee Williams keep dropping hints about it. A race develops as to whether Blanche will attain her magic marriage proposal from Mitch before the big revelation, or her breakdown, or some other tragic outcome from her simmering antagonism with Stanley. This 1951 film is an actor's feast. Three of the leads replay their parts from their Broadway triumph, directed both on stage and in this film by Aliyah Kazan. They more than hold their own, no doubt due to their long honing of these characters on stage. Vivian Leigh also makes the most of her part, coming fresh from her London performance and replacing Jessica Tandy in the film. Imagine a blonde Scarlett O'Hara in her failed later years. You can probably tell that I wasn't a fan of this film, despite the acting masterclasses on display. I found the story set-bound and unengaging, although I may feel differently if I saw it live on stage. Streetcar was selected by Gemma Livingston, although she's studying the play rather than the film. But Ricardo, you're allowed to be wrong, I mean to have a different opinion. What did you think?
Look, I was really looking forward to this. I hadn't seen it.
Okay. I'd seen it a long time ago. I could remember it.
But I never had. So I loved Elia Kazan's On the Waterfront.
Which I haven't seen.
And I really loved that film. But I'd never seen this. And I'd wanted to. I just hadn't done it. I'd never even seen the Tennessee Williams play. So, and I know so many sort of amateur theatre companies or different theatre companies do it. But I'd never seen that either. I'd seen Brando's Stella.
Oh, everyone's seen Stella.
Everybody's seen that, okay? And I've heard the line, you know, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers.
Which is right at the very end.
Yeah, it is right at the end.
I kept waiting for it.
Yeah. So I'd heard that line. I didn't really know the story at all, really, as I was going into it. But my thoughts? I found this completely boring.
Yes, I fell asleep at least twice.
I really didn't care for the story, which was so monotonous. I mean, I cared for none of the characters.
No. I probably came closest to Stella herself, the sister.
Stella was great. Kim Hunter.
They're all great actors.
Oh, look, Vivian Leigh, Blanche irritated me all the way through it. I thought it was just an overacted performance. I actually didn't like it. It was overacted,
but I still... It's funny. I thought it was overacted, but it's a neurotic character, and I thought, well, maybe that's what she's trying to do.
But it was the same all the way through, and I just...
No, she switched a bit.
Well, she switches at the end when she starts going crazy, but...
But sometimes she was being the charming Southern Belle, and yeah, everything was a bit magic, and then she'd cut through of her line where you could see the real character beneath. Mm. So I actually thought the performances were good, as I said, but like you, I just didn't care about the characters. I wasn't engaged by the story, and it really... you've talked in the past about when a play is filmed,
yes,
like The Odd Couple.
That's right.
And it doesn't break out.
It doesn't break out.
And we'll talk about Rear Window, which is a one set movie, but is so much more successful.
Yeah.
This feels like almost a literal translation.
It does, and it does feel like a play.
Look, but even the titles, the opening titles, you know, are saying things like the Pulitzer Prize, a New York Critics Award play.
Yes, yeah.
And I thought, it's a bit try-hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it was. It was a filmed version of the play.
Yeah, I mean, this goes down as a classic, this film.
Yeah.
This is what really surprised me. Now, I love old films, right? We've done old movies if you watch...
Hell, we've even done black and white.
Yeah, that's right. we've done silent movies.
But yes.
Look, if you listen to the podcast, you know that we're not adverse to watching good old cinema.
Let's go the other way. We both love old cinema.
So I was really looking forward to it. I'd just sit there and watch this really good movie. But I was just... It was a snooze fest to me. I couldn't wait for it to end. So, look, now the performance of Brando, look, he's great, okay?
And the black and white camera loves him.
Oh.
You know that description by Clive James of Arnold Schwarzenegger, like, you know, walnut stuffed in a condom? Mm. He was like that at times with his, like, T-shirt or ripped T-shirt, and you can see just the smooth pattern of his biceps.
Yeah.
He looks... fantastic. You understand the sexual magnetism.
He was in his prime.
Oh, yeah.
That is Brando. You don't see a better Brando than in this
movie. Have you seen his Mark Anthony?
No.
I'd like to, actually.
No,
I haven't seen that. Apparently he was good in that. But he does do the mumbling stuff too.
Well, he does. But
at times.
Again, I think that's a part of his acting technique. I mean, he studied method acting, which is the Stanislavski technique.
Well, let's talk about method acting.
Yeah,
and again, this is your background, not mine.
Look, it's a technique whereby actors identify as closely as possible with the character, correlating experiences from their personal lives in that character. Okay. It is quite a technique, okay? But essentially, it's about bringing a real truthness to that character because you invest some of your life into it, okay?
So the character might use words like truthness.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, possibly. It's not playing yourself, but it's finding your character first and foremost and then using aspects of your life.
Right? Brando himself denied that he was a method actor.
Yeah.
He said that Lee Strasberg, who you mentioned, I think...
It was Stanislavski.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So Lee Strasberg was one of the three major...
That's right.
And Pacino
was a big one for Lee Strasberg.
Yeah, but I did a bit of background reading on Google and Wikipedia and so on, so I'm an expert now.
You're an expert.
So there were the three kind of, then I guess, heirs or descendants of Stanislavski. There was Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, and another guy whose name escapes me.
Yeah, okay.
What I read was that Brando said, look, you know, I had success, and then Lee Strasberg tried to take credit off. He's actually not at all a fan of Strasberg, it's quite clear. So he says, look, you know, Strasberg basically tried to claim me as his method acting pupil, and it's not what I was, and yet he's often the one you hear mentioned in this context.
He is, actually, Lee Strasberg, he is.
Brando,
that's right, he is. I mean, everyone knows. Yeah, Pacino was a Lee Strasberg. You got De Niro, who was very method as well in his roles as well, and Dustin Hoffman as well. You've heard about the famous story in
Laurence Olivier. Yes,
Laurence Olivier
in Marathon Man.
Yeah,
go on, tell it.
You can tell the story. Go for it. You mentioned.
Okay, so the story is that for those who don't know the Marathon Man, Laurence Olivier is a Nazi dentist who's torturing the Marathon Man, Dustin Hoffman. We're off on a big tangent here, but never mind. They were doing a torture scene, and they were on set, and Hoffman arrives looking completely dishevelled, and Olivier says, what's wrong with you? And Hoffman says, oh, well, I was up all night, and I didn't sleep, and I did this, that, and the other, so they'll be in the part for this guy being tortured. And Olivier said to him, my dear boy, haven't you heard of acting? And while
it's a classic. It's a classic.
While I'm on a roll, the other quote I found was Charles Laughton, who worked closely for a while with Bertolt Brecht, and he said, "Method actors give you a photograph, while real actors give you an oil painting," but in a British accent.
Yeah, right. Well, it probably sounded a little bit better then.
It probably did. And my, how they laughed at the time. Mm. Yes, but let's get back to Streetcar.
Let's get back to Streetcar. I'm still unsure. At the very end, when you've got Brando and Blanche...
Hammer and tongs
at the very end. Is he meant to have been violent with her in terms of that?
Well, it's hinted that he's raped her.
Yeah, it's hinted that. But I do not believe that.
No, I
if
don't
that's
either.
That's the case. I don't believe that that's happened. Because the character which you've seen that whole time wouldn't do it.
Well, I mean,
I don't think he would at that moment.
I actually think the relationship between Stanley and Blanche is actually one of the weak points because they are so averse to each other quickly.
Mm.
They go from 0 to 100 before there's really any reason. And I think it's strongly implied, if not actually said, this is actually the first time they've met.
Yeah.
And he's very focused on, you know, what happened to the estate? You know, should I be getting something out of this because, you know, your sister is my wife?
Oh, but that went on and on.
And you can imagine that Blanche would be the house guest from hell. They've basically got two rooms.
Yeah.
And she takes over and, you know, perfumes everything and basically stops them having sex because she's there and takes over the bathroom. So you can imagine that she would very quickly get on his nerves, but it's just too quick.
And at the very end, when Kim Hunter says, I'm never going back, no, you are. Absolutely you are. There's no way. She went back every time.
Yes.
And you know, his charm. And because they were good together when she wasn't there, when Blanche wasn't there.
Yes,
and he says that, you know, we'll get back to old times.
Well, they mirror the upstairs couple. They're constantly fighting and reuniting.
Yes.
And that's how they live.
Yeah.
Yeah, but those couples live on top of each other quite literally as well. Mm. But I did really like Kim Hunter as Stella. Although Marlon Brando is very, very charismatic, I thought Kim Hunter was just really great. When she comes down the stairs after he calls out, Stella!
Yes.
And some of her reactions.
Yeah.
And I look at her and think, you know, she didn't do a lot in film. Her main claim to fame 15 years later was she was the main female ape in the Planet of the Apes films in the late 60s.
Yeah, right.
And I hadn't realised that she is the love interest, yeah, the main female character in A Matter of Life and Death, which is a film, an early David Niven film that I'd like us to talk about one day.
Right.
Michael Powell and co film, which I really like. It's a very unusual film for that time in some ways. But she was in that, but I would never recognise her. But she really... She's not the lead. The leads are Blanche and Stanley, and yet she really shines.
Mm.
And Carl Malden is very good too. You know, I always think of Carl Malden as being the old cop from Streets of San Francisco.
That's exactly right.
And he is, you know, very good in a kind of a sturdy kind of role.
Yeah, I quite liked him as well. I quite like him as an actor. Every time I watch him, he's fine. But again, his love for Blanche, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe he'd be so into her.
And then turn so quickly too.
Yeah, that's right.
I agree.
So it was just clunky to me. It felt like 3 hours, it was two.
Maybe you wouldn't know so much on stage.
On stage, I don't think you would. I think it would be better on stage than film.
I think they need to pick this up and shake it a bit before they made a film out of it.
Blandly directed too. I didn't think it was particularly well directed.
You liked On the Waterfront, didn't you?
Yeah, I love On the Waterfront, but it's not a play. I think that's a major issue.
Well, it's more than that. This is a play that was very, very successful.
Yeah.
You take three of the four main characters. Mm-hmm. I feel very sorry for Jessica Tandy getting dropped.
Yes,
You take three of the four and you bring someone else from another production into it, from London, and you had the exact same director.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a couple of breakout shots, like at the start at the train station.
Yeah.
Everything's on what's obviously a stage set.
Yeah.
Which, again, is true of Rear Window, but you don't feel it.
You know it's
not real, but it doesn't matter. Whereas here it just felt wrong.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about this film is that this was the first of four consecutive nominations that Brando had for Best Actor
in
the Oscars.
Consecutive?
Yeah, consecutive.
Which films were they for?
There was one called Viva Zabata, which I've not known much about. The other two might have been Julius Caesar and something else. But, yeah, four back-to-back, which is extraordinary. So where did you sit with the score-wise?
I'm going to give this 4 out of 10.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, for me it's a 5.
Yeah. I think I've said my reasons.
And I've said...
Disappointed. Disappointed.
Gemma, sorry. But, hey, you're studying the play, so that's okay. So our second film in Year 12 homework is the 2009 film Invictus. And we chose this film because actually I have a son, Teo, in Year 12, and they're studying this film. And in fact, this gave us the idea for film club. So, Ricardo, tell us about my son's film. No pressure.
No, it's okay. Okay, Invictus. Look, it's always interesting to see what Clint Eastwood directs because his films are so varied. From thriller, Play Misty For Me, to Western, Unforgiven, to romance, The Bridges of Madison County, to action, Space Cowboys, to autobiographical, Bird, to war, Flags of Our Fathers, drama, Million Dollar Baby, I could go on. But now we have him turning his attention to an inspiring true story, Invictus. Nelson Mandela was an anti-apartheid revolutionary. After serving 27 years in prison for conspiring to overthrow the state in 1962, he became the first South African head of state who was black, the first elected in a fully representative democratic election. Becoming the president of South Africa, he wanted to dismantle apartheid and unite his nation. Invictus tells the story of how Mandela saw the South African rugby team, the Springboks, who were until this point considered the team representing only white South Africa, as a way to bring the country together. Mandela even denounced this team in prison. However, as president, he says, you know, how could I ask others to change if he could not? Matt Damon plays Francois, the captain of the Springboks team, that is doing very badly. They only made the World Cup because they were hosting it. Enter Mandela, Morgan Freeman, who inspires Francois to guide his team to win the World Cup, against all odds, and reunite a country torn apart by apartheid. Now, as a director, Clint Eastwood is a storyteller first and foremost. He doesn't use fancy camera work or direct with a huge amount of flair. Unlike Scorsese or Hitchcock, you can't usually tell that a film is by his hand. He's very subtle, but he directs true to the story he's telling. This film shows how important sport can be in bringing together a nation. And when Australia made the World Cup final at the 2003 Rugby World Cup, or the Socceroos made the round of 16 at the FIFA World Cup in 2006... there was an overwhelming sense of pride amongst us all, and Mandela saw the importance of this at such a critical time in their history. Look, I really loved this film. The performances were all wonderful. Damon impresses and did really well with a great South African accent, and Morgan Freeman was amazing in the role he was born to play. Now, Greg, what did you think of Invictus?
You're right. This is the role that Morgan Freeman was born to play. In fact, he met Mandela, and apparently they got on very well. And when you start by saying it's always interesting to see what Clint Eastwood directs because his films are so varied, this is the first of his films I've ever seen.
Are you serious?
All those films you rattled off, Play Misty for Me, Unforgiven, Bridges of Madison County, Space Cowboys, Bird, Flags of Our Fathers, and the other one, Letters from Iwo Jima, is it?
Yes.
And Million Dollar Baby, I have not seen any of those films.
Really?
So we'll give you a moment just to absorb that and for our listeners to absorb that.
Now, that is a major confession.
We are not doing a Clint Eastwood episode.
No, but that is amazing. You've never seen a... Clint Eastwood's directed 40 films.
Well, I don't know how many of his films that he's in I've actually seen. We did The Good, The Bad and The Ugly earlier this season.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, I've missed Paint Your Wagon. I mean, I know his face.
You never saw Million Dollar Baby?
No, he's been around forever and I'm very unaware of his work. And certainly, as I say, never seen a film he'd made before.
Gran Torino?
No.
No? Jeepers.
Look, I'll get IMDb out. We'll go through the whole list. And I'll just say no.
Sorry,
no,
I won't bore you with that. No. Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, well, that was a great discussion. The next film we're going to...
Yeah, that just shocked me. Okay.
No, this film didn't do it for me.
What? Really?
I thought it was going to twice. I really liked the opening shot when Mandela's been released, 11th of February, 1990. Yes. And they're going down. And I remember that happening. In fact, I remember the Springbok tours in the 70s when I was at school being quite controversial. I won't claim it all to understand what's going on, but I remember that it was very, very controversial because it was seen as being that figurehead of the apartheid system, you know, as being something that was almost propagating that culture across the world through rugby, you know, or validating or something. And so it was a genuine target of social activism. I remember that. So I remember that this was very controversial. So the opening shot where the motorcade goes down the road and on either side of the road there are the two worlds on a rugby pitch.
Mm-hmm.
There's what I think is a very privileged white school.
There is.
Beautiful resource, great green lawns, you know, an old wealthy building in the background behind it. And on the other side is the dirt field. And even the two different fences, the very nice, you know, institutional fence with the stonework and metal, whatever it was, and then the kind of the barbed wire fence. That was a really interesting scene.
It sets it up really nicely.
It does. And I thought, beauty. But I think it told the wrong story. I think there's actually a better story in here waiting to be told. Now, as you know, and everyone in my life knows, I am not a sports fan. And I'm a bit of an anomaly, if I can say that word, in my family too. It just by and large doesn't touch me. Sometimes a sports film will when it becomes transcendent. So, you know, and one day I'd like to talk about the film Field of Dreams. Mm. I love Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams uses the realm of sports to actually tell a story which is partly about mythos
mm-hmm.
and very much about fathers and sons. Mm. And I love the elements of that. I love the fantastical.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it actually brings me into an understanding of the game of baseball and okay. all the myth around it. And I understand why people love it. I don't get that about rugby from this film. So I would happily go and see a game of baseball on the back of Field of Dreams because I kind of get it.
But this is the true story. It's about sport. I know. It could have been any sport.
Yeah. And look, there are moments. I really liked when the actual big game was going on
mm.
and there was the little on running vignette outside in the street with the young black child, the white taxi drivers.
Yes.
Who at first are antagonistic and by the end they're sharing cokes and he's getting one of their caps and so on.
That's right.
I mean, I like that and I got the story it's trying to tell.
Well, all of the small characters really do that in the film. I mean, they do go on a journey. They do. And his minders and they all go on a journey towards...
But that was actually the journey I was more interested in.
Mm.
And so there was one part of the film when I was really moved, like I felt like sobbing. And that was the scene where, against their own desire, the team is made by Mandela to go out and do the rugby clinics in the township. And they go in, and the Matt Damon character's a bit, I guess, betwixt and between. The others just don't want to be there. Even the token black member of the team, they don't want to be there. And yet when they get off the bus and they mix the kids and they share the joy of the rugby...
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene.
It's a lovely scene. Mm. And that was the film I ended up hoping to see. And not knowing the story and not even knowing the outcome of the game, because I just don't pay attention to the sporting world. I get some things about it, but it's just not where I'm at.
Mm.
And I would have actually much rather seen the story of what happened to the individual team members. So in the team, the Matt Damon character is pretty present.
Mm-hmm.
So is Chester, the black team member. And the others are all totally forgettable.
They are forgettable.
Yeah. We get the story set up where they're asked to sing, you know, the new national anthem. They're screwing it up, and Matt Damon's saying, "Well, only if you want to," and no one wants to. And then they're playing on behalf of the unified country. I wanted to see the story of how the individual members of the team, Matt Damon, Chester, and the others, or at least some of the others, the journey they went on, where they had some kind of revelation or transformation of them as people. I thought a lot of what was going on there was tokenistic. Even in the household of Francois's family, his father is obviously strongly in favour of apartheid.
That's right. Yeah.
His mother kind of almost excuses the father's behaviour.
That's right. Yeah.
The wife, you know, I'm not quite sure where she was.
Mm-hmm.
And they all go to the game together and they take the black housemaid because Matt Damon gives them the ticket. And they hug each other during the game. But I just thought, I'm so uninterested in the story and I really want to be. And I would rather see someone come along and tell the other story.
Yeah.
I would love to see that, even though I don't know about or care about rugby.
Well, you don't... I sort of agree with you that you don't get a sense of how it's affected that family. I thought I'd see a scene somewhere where there would be a conclusion with the father and his character and what his thoughts are.
Or the mother standing up to him, perhaps.
Or something like that, because they set it up in the beginning. They set him up as completely in favour of apartheid, and then and then towards the end he's there, and is he just there proud of his son, or is he in favour of what's happening now? Is everybody loving him?
Well, in fact, you get more of a sense of the maid and the mother and not the wife or the father in the second row. They're just kind of there, you know.
One thing I didn't think the film needed, and I know they do it for dramatic effect, was the sort of mock assassination attempts.
Actually, I like that scene.
Yeah, I mean, they're good scenes. Like, they're good for dramatic effect, but...
The one at the start.
Yeah, there's one at the start.
Not so much the aeroplane
one. The aeroplane one was a bit too much, I thought. But maybe that happened. It did happen, apparently.
But, you know, this film is 8 years after 9/11.
Yeah.
And so it has a much more potent meaning at the time the film was made than when that actually happened.
Of course, yeah.
But I also thought the plane crashed. This is a true story. The plane crashed, I probably would have known about it, even me. So I wasn't sure what was happening there, but I didn't feel... I kind of felt the dread of that moment post 9/11, but I didn't feel like it was really going to happen.
Mm.
I just didn't know what was really going on.
You know, I love sport. Understanding and the fact that, you know, he used that to inspire a nation to come together.
Mandela comes across as a very clever man.
A very clever man. A bit flirty too with his
mate. I think he might have been, actually. He's not a saint.
Yeah, no. But after 27 years in prison, okay.
And I like the character of his assistant, Brenda.
Yes, she's great too.
Who's been the warning voice about don't waste your political capital on something which is, you know, just sport.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the story they're trying to tell, but I would have preferred less of the game, and the game was the culmination across the population of this change of heart. But I wanted to see the team story, and I think it was the wrong story.
I thought you got not the team story, but just I think you're wanting a bit of a different film here.
Okay? Oh, I am. I'm
completely wanting a different film. But if you just make it about the team and what the way it's affected them, you sort of lose the Mandela aspect of it. I mean, unless
you can tell both those stories. So you can tell a Mandela story, and that was interesting to a point. But you could tell the story of the team members as the microcosm of the country and then see the realisation of that more broadly through the game, the child and the taxi drivers outside. And, you know, you got a bit of that, as you say, the bodyguards. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because they start as quite hostile to
each other.
Very
hostile, yeah.
And they reflect, you know, me way, way outside the whole situation. What I understand of, there were people who had to deal with each other and forgive each other who may have actually killed friends and family.
That's right.
I mean, what an extraordinary situation.
Yeah.
So I got that, and I thought the bodyguards is a microcosm of that. That part actually worked well.
It did.
I wanted to see that journey in the team members. I just didn't believe it.
I think it was there, but they didn't really focus on that in the screenplay. So, yeah. I mean, that's a choice to make when you're writing. It's a choice they would have made because essentially when you're looking at a two-character story, really. It's Francois and Morgan Freeman, really.
Even Francois didn't feel completely realised to me, I have to say.
Oh, no, he did to me. I thought Matt Damon played him very well.
I thought he played him well with material he had. I just...
You don't get a sense with when the father's going on about, you know, not liking Mandela, getting the presidency or whatnot, you know, we're going to go to the dogs sort of stuff. Matt Damon never says it. Francois never says anything, right? So you never know what he's thinking or how his views are.
He wasn't that inspirational in the team either. Like, you know, oh, guys, here's the anthem. Maybe you could sing it, you know. Like, he never really steps up, I didn't think.
No, he doesn't on that moment. No, he doesn't.
But in the whole film, he's impressed by Mandela.
Well, the very
and
end.
And he goes along with him. The one thing he does, he makes that comment saying, in response to the interviewer who's giving him a hard time all through the film, he says to him, no, it wasn't the X 100,000 people here, it's the 43 million in our country.
In our country.
That's a great line.
It's a great line.
But it comes out of nowhere. Like, he's not a character to me that really transforms. He kind of goes with the flow and he doesn't really inspire anyone or confront anyone and say, no, this is wrong or we really need to be different as a team. I wasn't engaged. And it wasn't just because it was a sports film. I just think they told the wrong story.
But he has to toe a line as well. He can't just come in and be a different person and go, oh, I've met Mandela. Everybody has to do this and everybody has to do that. I think it's more realistic.
It could have been a journey. Like, you know,
I saw a journey in him, though.
I didn't see it. I wondered to what degree it was hamstrung because it's a true story.
Yeah.
And because most of these people were still alive at the time the film was made.
Yeah.
So you can't invent the story. And it was based on a book by someone who's now wasn't one of the characters in the film, John Carlin, maybe, who I assume is a sports journalist or something. Yeah. And I understand that that game was really a striking moment, not just in South African history, but in sport history. I get that, but it's pretty amazing.
It's like saying the World Cup in Qatar is, you know, coming up in 4 years.
Yep.
Qatar have never made the World Cup. They're not a very good team. It's like them winning the World Cup. I mean, that's what it was pretty much like. The Springboks were not a very good team.
Get the old videos out and watch those.
Yeah.
And I have to say, for someone who does not understand the game of rugby, I don't think it really tried to bring me into how the game worked.
Mm.
So during the game scenes of the actual game, when you got the headlocked two teams, I had no idea what was really going on, what was good play in that game. Whereas in baseball, I get it.
Yeah, but with football, in terms of rugby or say gridiron for American football, I never know what's going on in the movies. I mean, they're just bumping into each other and going, hey, don't go long, blah, blah, blah. I never understand. It's not really about what the game. I think it's more about the sport. I mean, that's a true story. Happened at the Rugby World Cup. Yeah, it could have been soccer, it could have been any World Cup, really. I mean, he's wanting to bring together a nation on any sport. It didn't have to be rugby. That was just the true story aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, I think I've made my feelings on this film pretty clear.
Yeah.
And I'm really sorry, Teo, my son, because I wanted to like this because this is the film you're studying. I just didn't. I wanted a different film. It left me cold.
Cold? No, I was very moved.
With two exceptions. Three exceptions. The opening shot, the stuff towards the end with the taxi drivers and the kid. And I was incredibly moved when they went to the township. And I felt like I was being set up for a very different film, which I would rather have seen. And for me, it's a 5 out of 10.
Oh, 5. Jeepers, that's low.
Yes.
I'm giving it an 8. I was really moved by the film. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10. I understood it. I understood the love of sport and what that can do. Just on a grassroots level, club football or anything like that. It's about belonging. And so it was a very intelligent way for Mandela to try and bring together a nation. And also, it was amazing that they even did it. To even win that World Cup.
Yeah, I got that.
Is amazing. So it's amazing. I understood the intent.
I understood the historical context to a point, as I remember it. But
I was moved. Yeah. I was moved. So the third film we are going to discuss is Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. So where did this come from, Greg?
So this film is being studied by Ellen Moore. So a big shout out to her as part of her Year 12 as well.
Right.
And this is actually our fourth Hitchcock film review, after Psycho, Vertigo and Rope, which must be some kind of record for us.
I think so. That is actually.
But at least there's two words in this title, so we're obviously making progress.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we are not reviewing the 1998 TV remake starring the real-life paralyzed Christopher Reeve, which is an interesting spin on it. But let's talk about this version.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
So in this 1954 film, Jimmy Stewart plays Jeff, another Hitchcock everyman who has been stuck in a wheelchair for 6 weeks in his apartment after a work-related accident. To keep himself occupied and perhaps sane, he watches his neighbours through his rear window into theirs and the courtyard below. As a photographer, he's also able to use zoom lenses and binoculars for the detail when something catches his voyeuristic eye. Jeff has two regular visitors, Stella, another Stella, the insurance nurse who provides daily massages and chit-chat, played by the always delightfully dry Thelma Ritter, and Lisa, the glamorous fashion worker who wants to marry him. Lisa is played by Grace Kelly, only a few years before she married and became the Princess of Monaco in real life. And never has someone looked so radiant as she does in this film, beginning with an amazing close-up as she gives Jeff a slow-mo kiss as he awakes in his wheelchair. Unfortunately, Jeff finds her too perfect. He can't decide if they should marry, as he feels they are very different and have different life goals. His deliberations are reflected in his observation of his neighbours at different stages of singledom, romance and marriage. In particular, Jeff focuses, figuratively and literally, on a neighbour across the courtyard who may have murdered his wife and disposed of the body. Stella, Lisa and a war buddy cop, Doyle, played by Wendell Corey, are gradually drawn into Jeff's observations and theories about the possible murder. And Lisa becomes the active agent for our wheelchair-bound protagonist, which really is ourselves, for her own excitement as a way of becoming Jeff's true love. So, Ricardo, on behalf of Ellen, who probably now keeps her curtains well shut, what did you think?
This is my favourite Hitchcock film.
Wow, that's a big claim.
Because it starts perfectly and ends perfectly. It never misses a beat. It starts with the blinds opening and it sets up the characters beautifully. And the things what I love about Hitchcock is the way he moves the camera. This is someone who doesn't need a lot of dialogue. And I think Hitchcock didn't really like dialogue that much. He uses the camera to say the words with expression, and only Hitchcock does it.
Well, if you go back to our second ever episode where we did Psycho and Vertigo, I remember we spoke about the same thing. I was marvelling, because I'd never seen Psycho before, and I have seen Rear Window a long time ago. I was marvelling at the fact that either side of the shower, the famous shower scene, with the exception of, the music and I think Janet Leigh kind of screaming as she stabbed, understandably, there is no dialogue. There's only sound. And this happens a lot in this film. Mm. And in fact, this time around, I was really aware of the use of sound and silence and music and non-dialogue.
Yeah. And really, I mean, this is like a movie within a movie.
Go on.
We pretty much are Jimmy Stewart watching on. Most of the time. He never goes outside of that apartment and decides to go into the other apartments to see what's going on. He keeps us there. I mean, I could see...
Oh, Hitchcock, you mean?
Yeah, Hitchcock. Yes. He could have really gone in there and said, okay, let's get some other shots of inside the apartment or whatnot.
He was going to. Did you know that?
Oh, really?
No. You know early on when Jimmy Stewart's character is on the phone to his editor?
Yeah.
That scene, was filmed in the newspaper offices. It was all set up. And one of the... I saw an interview with one of the associate producers who said that he told Hitchcock he thought that scene was wrong. And on the way to filming it, sometime later, Hitchcock asked him if he still felt that way, and he did. And they went and filmed it, but only used the audio. Hitchcock realised what you're saying, which is keep it all there. This is like Lifeboat. Have you seen Lifeboat?
No, I haven't.
Like Lifeboat, it is a one location story, which is really hard.
And in terms of the way all the characters outside you are looking at, and it's very voyeuristic. This is all about voyeurism.
In the same way I said to you that Vertigo is about necrophilia. This is about being a peeping Tom.
That's right. Yeah, there's that line which Thelma Ritter says. It says, we've become a nation of peeping Toms. We should, you know, all get out of our house a little more, you know.
Where she calls Jeff a window shopper on stage as well.
And I feel like that's really prevalent to today as well, with everybody just Facebook stalking and whatnot. I just find it's quite relevant to today a little, you know.
I think you're right. And if I was doing this as a Year 12 class assignment, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot that could be drawn out of this terms of the way that our lives are on display. One of the differences is that people knowingly put on display their lives.
Yes.
And in fact, massage it. You only see the happy shots and the nice food and, mm-hmm. you know, families doing great stuff together. You don't see the mess.
Yeah, that's right.
But in this, I mean, all those people must have known their lives were on display, and no one seems to care.
No one seems to care, that's right.
Even Miss Torsten.
But they even make reference of that. The cops say, look, would he really
have his
blinds open and do that? But it's hot, though. It's hot. So everybody's had their blinds open because it's hot. I think they get away with it because they set up that it's bloody hot.
Even Miss Torso, the ballet dancer, the first time you see her, I have to say, it felt really pervy.
Yeah, it is very...
She's put her bra on.
Yeah, that's
and then
right.
He's doing those high kicks, you know.
Yeah, she's bending over at the fridge, you know.
I know, and I thought, in some ways, that is the most voyeuristic scene, little vignette in the whole film, where you feel like a perv.
Well, I felt that actually in the married couple section.
The newlyweds or the
newlyweds? Oh, yeah. The newlyweds going in. I thought, I really shouldn't be watching this. You know,
but they pull the blind out.
They do. Yeah. And that's beautiful. It's perfect.
This running joke about Harry. and in fact, you know, so the whole story takes place in less than a week. I think it's about 4 days or something.
Yeah.
So they arrive at the start of that sequence as newlyweds, and after only 4 days, they are not only, you know, she wants lots of sex, obviously. Yeah. He's kind of like, but they're starting to have the little arguments after only 4 days.
Yeah,
you know, it's really compressed.
Yeah. But you know what I loved? I loved that sequence in one of the characters with the lonely woman.
Miss Lonely Hearts?
Lonely Hearts.
Yep.
And she's play-acting, play-acting that scene, which plays really beautifully when you're watching it.
And even Jimmy Stewart raising his glass to her when she raises her glass to a non-existent suitor.
Yeah. But you're right about Grace Kelly. Stunning.
I saw it a long time ago.
Stunning.
So the first time you see her,
that close-up is just...
She's radiant.
She's radiant. She is.
And
she
the second is. Time you see her...
But it's her personality as well. Her demeanour, everything about her is great. And you know what? I just love the ending of the film. I think it's so perfect because...
When she's reading,
and she fills out her bazaar after reading something quite intelligent, and then she brings out
She's reading a book that's his lifestyle.
His life, yeah.
Across the Andes or something.
That's right, exactly.
And then when he's asleep, she drops it and she goes back to Harper's Bazaar.
That's right. I love it.
And
it's
her
perfect.
Dresses are stunning. Edna Head, you know, the famous Hollywood costume designer. Particularly the first one with the black kind of almost sleeveless top and the full white skirt, the little black embroidery is stunning.
It is stunning.
The dress when she goes over the fence and goes into the guy's apartment with the clues.
Yes.
That kind of... I mean, I love women's clothes in the 50s, that whole tailored
thing. So do I, yeah.
But I look back on her in To Catch a Thief or High Society.
Mm.
She's good looking, but she's a little cold or neurotic in those characters. Here...
No, there's a real warmth here.
There's a warmth. And you know, you hear that expression, you know, the camera makes love to an actor or actress. Mm-hmm. I think when you first see her, this is the epitome of that kind of sentiment.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's in love with her.
And Jimmy Stewart is always serviceable and always fantastic. So he's very good in this as well. And they banter off each other very, very well.
I don't
even
want to say he's serviceable. He is a really good actor.
He's an amazing actor. but I mean, he's always good. That's what I'm saying.
Well, you look
at
films that we love.
Yeah.
Rear Window, obviously.
Yes.
Vertigo.
Yes.
It's a Wonderful Life. Mm-hmm. He did a few other Hitchcock films as well, like The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah.
And I've never really been interested in watching him in Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are some of my all-time Hollywood favourite films across, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. The Philadelphia Story of Cary Grant and Captain Hepburn.
I haven't seen that, yeah.
Which is the precursor of High Society before the music. Jimmy Stewart's in all these films. And it's not because he's serviceable. he isn't everyman kind of character, but there's also, he does depth. You can see things happening behind his eyes.
Oh, you can.
You believe him when he gets traumatized in Vertigo
mm-hmm.
and becomes obsessive himself. Mm-hmm. He's a really great actor.
He's a fantastic actor. I mean, everybody, they're all very good in this. But like I said, the script is great, turning point. Yeah, but it's the voyeurism. It's the way the story plays out. It really builds. I mean, he is the master of suspense, and this shows it.
Well, there's a great scene, too, that when Lisa, Grace Kelly, is in the suspected murderer's apartment, Lars, played mm-hmm. by Raymond Burr, who she mentioned,
mm.
most people know as Ironside in the 50s or 60s on mm. TV. You've got Lars, I think, in the kitchen, Lisa in the bedroom, mm-hmm. and below them, Miss Lonely Heart,
mm-hmm.
so the three L's, if you like. But there's a really nice kind of tableau of the three of them in different kind of postures.
Mm.
Again, one of the really impressive about things is just how much in control Hitchcock is. And it's lovely that, he always makes his little cameo appearance. He's winding a clock in the piano composer's apartment.
That's right.
He is winding up the machinery. I mean, this film is full of symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I loved, I did a bit of reading around this because I was just fascinated by the whole set as well. So this was the tallest soundstage that had ever been attempted.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the studio wasn't high enough. So you know what they did? They cut out the floor, and so the courtyard is actually the basement where they usually stored things.
Oh, wow.
And so one level up was actually truly the ground level, which I think was the level of Jimmy Stewart's apartment. They had four settings for the lights, which was morning, afternoon, twilight, mm-hmm. and night. They had the rain stuff installed.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly for its time, but even now, these days you do it with CGI or something else, but...
No, they did that very well. They did it very well.
It's extraordinary.
Because it's unlike, let's say, Streetcar Named Desire, which was very set.
Yeah, it looked like a set.
You could tell.
And you knew this had to be set because of the way it worked.
And
but
it was. But the thing is, the outside, when you looked past the buildings, they did that well.
That reminded me of Rope, actually. You know that out the window in Rope mm-hmm. that had that kind of sunset thing?
Yeah.
And I like the fact that you could see just down one little alleyway to the outside world, you see cars go past.
Yes.
And you could see into the restaurant.
Yeah, they did that well.
Yeah.
They did all of that well. What a film.
What about the way women are treated in this film?
Okay.
Lisa is a paragon of virtue. Like mm-hmm. it's really interesting. Like she would be the epitome of the idealized Hitchcock woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's blonde, but she's not the ice cold, kind of character, the ice queen kind of character. So I felt really odd about that pervy part with Miss Torso. The thing that really struck me, and I don't quite know what to make of it, and this is where I'm going to do my year 12 best impersonation. You know that famous shot that we've talked about before, when at the very beginning you're in Jimmy Stewart's apartment and mm-hmm. the camera pans over a number of objects, the smashed camera, the photos, mm-hmm. and you know why he's had his leg in a cast.
That's right. It's very,
And you see...
Clear.
You see then a negative image of a model and then you see the same photo on the magazine cover mm-hmm. next to it and she's some famous model or something. You've got the framed photograph of the negative image of a woman. And I wondered, given that this film is very strong on symbolism, like the wedding ring itself, which is the central clue, is Hitchcock saying something about, the negative image of women? I don't know.
No, I didn't get that at all. I didn't get that at all. I mean, I know Hitchcock in his private life had,
issues,
but I didn't get it in this film.
But
I think she's quite a strong woman. I think Grace Kelly's character is quite a strong woman.
She's
probably
the strongest woman character in all these films.
And
she's not a victim because half the time his female characters are either a means to an end in the story. Mm-hmm. They're a woman of mystery and maybe he's actually the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's those question marks over Eva Marie Saint in North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Or she is a victim, like mm-hmm. in Frenzy or
Psycho.
Psycho, obviously. Or she's the good girl or the bad girl.
Yeah, he's not Lars von Trier, though.
Well, I can't really comment beyond we see Dancer in the Dark. Yeah. But like Grace Kelly's character, Lisa, is just magnificent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way she leaps to the challenge.
Mm.
Yeah, I didn't know what to make of that negative framed photo. Was that just trying to say that, that was his photo?
It was his photo.
But it was such a striking image. I didn't know what to make of it.
I didn't get any symbolism in that in terms of negative aspects of women. Yeah, so I didn't get that.
I don't make too much of it. I just don't know what to make of that image because it was quite a strong image. The other thing I liked was that as he's watching all these neighbours, what you are seeing, including him and Lisa, what you are seeing is the different stages of romance. So you've got Miss Lonely Heart, who's having the horrible dating scene.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Miss Torso, who's fighting off the wolves.
He's fighting off the wolves, but also waiting for her.
And what's
man
true
to
love?
Yeah.
You've got Stuart and Kelly, the main characters who are on the cusp of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the newlyweds and kind of the deterioration very quickly of that. you've got the couple on the balcony with the mattress.
Yes.
Who are... Yeah, they're kind of marital familiarity.
Yes,
you know,
that's right.
And obviously just, you know, long-sustained mm-hmm. love.
Yes.
And then you've got the apartment where the wife might have been murdered, and certainly there's strong marital discord there.
So you get
across those apartments, and then you've got the bachelor as well, the composer.
Yeah.
Who's got the party crowd but not very happy, who ends up meeting Miss Lonelyheart,
which I really like. I really like that too, yeah.
And you've even got quite literally puppy love too.
But yeah, exactly. It,
so you've got the range across the courtyard.
And it wraps those stories up perfectly. It's not easy to do that.
I know.
Specifically when you're those characters, you're looking at them. You're not invested in them.
Well, because most of the time they're at a distance. You are literally distanced from
them. We are James Stewart.
And you can't even see very clearly, for example, Raymond Burr's face until right towards the end. You could happily not know it's Raymond Burr.
And because we are Jimmy Stewart, it makes it all the more creepy when suddenly, and that's why, when the camera pans up to him and he looks straight down the barrel, it's looking at you. I remember when I first saw this, Greg. I saw this when I was a teenager. Now, I was right into horrors. I was all into all those things. Now, I saw this. I thought, Rear Window. I'm going to watch Rear Window because I liked Psycho. And it was a slow burn. And I remember by the end of it, it was gripping. I just remember being so gripped by it. I'll never forget that.
Well, you know what? I was really attuned to this time around. So I saw it once, I don't know how long ago. I couldn't even tell if it was on a TV screen or a cinema, probably a TV. But this time around, I was really tuned into the use of sound and music. And so you've got, at one stage, they play the song Mona Lisa, and she is Lisa. Mm. You've got That's Amore. You've got operatic scales being sung by somebody somewhere. You've got the composer slowly trying to complete his melody as basically the relationship is getting resolved between Jeff and Lisa. You've got just silence or background noise. You know, the use of sound, not just lack of dialogue, but the overlaying of sounds in this is just masterful. Mm. It really is. So where are you going to sit with this one?
Oh, of course. I'm going to give this a 1. No, I'm giving it a 10, of course.
Oh, 1 out of 0.
That's right, a 1 out of 0. I'm giving it a 10. There's no point in going less than that.
Well, in our first season, I gave Vertigo, which I love, a 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled here because I thought, is this a 9? Like, how do I pitch this against Vertigo? I'm giving this a 10 as well.
Yeah.
It is a masterpiece.
Oh, I think this is far superior. This is superior to Vertigo. I know Vertigo is up there as one of the greatest films ever made.
I'm more intrigued by the story of Vertigo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But as we said when we talked about it, there are weak points like the Midge character, for
That's
example,
right.
that undermine it a bit.
Yeah.
But the story is a very compelling story. And there are scenes in that are extraordinary, like that revolving scene where you've got the two backgrounds.
I still think this is just as ambitious.
Yeah.
And perfectly handled.
And that beautiful scene of Grace Kelly, like that is memorable. It's indelible.
Those shots there, in two shots, you get that beautiful close-up and you see them kissing, that really passionate kiss, sets up their relationship in a second.
Yeah.
So beautifully done. You know, we've already know who James Stewart is. He's there. But to bring her in, we know where they are at. So brilliant.
And it's erotic.
Yes.
In a way that someone flashing their body parts is just not.
Absolutely. I agree. Completely agree with that. It really is. That is an amazing kiss. And she's just so amazing, Grace Kelly.
So that's our Year 12 homework episode. If you're a student, we hope we haven't completely taken you off track.
No, I don't think we have.
And you say that for Marxist, socialist revisionist reasons?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. I do want to say one thing before we leave Hitchcock behind.
Mm.
And you know, Ricardo, because I keep trying to get you to watch this program that I'm watching on Netflix, a Spanish TV series called The Ministry of Time. I just love it. It's light, it's dark, it's everything. But if you're remotely a Hitchcock devotee, you really must watch episode 1 of season 3, which is a complete homage to Vertigo and Hitchcock in general.
Mm.
And in fact, one day I'm going to watch that episode back-to-back with Vertigo. I've watched it twice already, and I've got you to watch half that episode.
You have.
It is just a joy.
Yeah.
To anyone who's remotely interested in film and Hitchcock, really, really watch season 3, episode 1 of the Spanish TV show The Ministry of Time, which I think, at least in Australia, is only on Netflix. Mm. But to Gemma and Ellen and my son Teo, we hope that you enjoyed this episode.
I hope you did. I hope we gave you a little bit to think about anyway when it comes to viewing these films.
And a whole lot of love.
That's right.
But let's talk about our next episode, Ricardo.
Yeah, so the next episode, episode 5 of this season 3, we're going to be looking at vintage thrillers, which I'm really eager to get into.
You've not seen any of these,
have you? I've seen none of them.
I've seen one of them a long time ago and bits of the other two.
Great.
Which
so,
you should never do with a
so it's, we're gonna it's gonna come across as quite fresh, okay, for both of us there. So I
that's the hope.
Yeah. The first film which I haven't seen, which is sacrilegious, I haven't seen this, but The Third Man, which is the 1949 Orson Welles film.
Yes. And in black and white. And our second film we'll move on to look at is another black and white thriller. Not a well-known film, The Night of the Hunter, 1955.
Robert Mitchum, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Lillian Gish, one of your favourites, mm-hmm. and the only film ever directed, I think, by Sir Charles Laughton.
Wow. Okay, and the third film we're going to be looking at is Wait Until Dark, which is a 1967 film by Terence Young, with Audrey Hepburn,
Alan Arkin, and it's colour.
And it's colour, which, but it's very vintage.
Yes, as are we.
Yes. So I'm really looking forward to getting into that for episode 5. I'm so glad. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed this episode.
And I hope next time we'll be less intimidating for me, thinking I've got to prep and sound like an academic. I'm just going to go for it and enjoy it.
Enjoy.